My name is Gabriel Nagme. I am with Portland Community College in the beautiful Portland, Oregon. I have to keep remembering to say Oregon because I'm on the other side of the country now, and there are two of them. Now, I know this is the technical track, and I got that great introduction, but I just want to preface this with saying that this is a semi-technical presentation. Yes, we are going to look at code, but really my purpose here is to define what an API is, tell you why I personally love them, and then go through a bunch of examples showcasing what you can do with APIs. To that end, since we only have 45 minutes in here, and I'm going to show you a lot of examples, I've already taken these slides and all the code for all these examples and put them on my website, which is gabriel.nagme.com. It's all up there. I'm a strong supporter of sharing. Share and share alike, so you can go and download those and get started. Not all of them are full examples, but they should point you in the right direction. And if you have any questions, feel free to hit me up via email, or if you've been on the back channel, I'm on Twitter all the time, so at Nagme. And I should be able to respond pretty quickly. So here's a little bit of an expanded overview of what we're going to talk about today. Again, we're going to define APIs and talk about what we've done with them at PCC, how we embrace them, and why we made those decisions. Then we're going to jump right into showcasing examples that we've done. Not all of these are from PCC, but most of them are. We're going to look at Google Maps, of course, which is one of the more famous ones that people have probably used. We're going to look at photos via Flickr, both managing and displaying them. Same thing with video via YouTube. And then we're going to look at some interesting examples with data via Google Analytics. If you look at my slides online, I actually had a whole section on social media as well, but I was going through the slides last night and I realized there's just way too much information. I could talk about any one of these subjects for 45 minutes. So something had to go. So I cut the Twitter section, but if you have any questions specifically about that, just let me know via email or via Twitter. And to that end, I'm going to go as fast as I can, and I'll leave some time at the end for questions, but I'll have to ask you to hold your questions until the end. So jumping right in, I want to define what an application programming interface, or API, is. Because if you type in API to an image search, and we were just talking about this, you get all sorts of convoluted charts and graphs. Arrows going this way, boxes over here, multiple things going on. And I wanted to explain it simpler. And at its base, this is really what it is. You have, on one side, a big web service. Google, Yahoo, Amazon. And you want to get to their juicy, juicy data. They've got data and features on their site that you want access to. But they're not just going to hand over the keys. They're not going to give you direct access to hit their databases, to look at their code. That wouldn't be a safe thing to do. So what they do is they build this interface, this gateway, that they do give you access to. This gateway can have many different forms in practice. Some of the examples we're going to look at use JavaScript. So you include one of their libraries, and then the client side does asynchronous calls to just get functions that it needs to do things on the other side. Other ones use RESTful XML. So you formulate your query as a URL, and when you hit that page, it displays the XML results right there, which you can then pull back in and do things with. The really cool thing is that for all of these big APIs that we're going to show you today, there's libraries built upon them. So you don't have to start from scratch. You don't have to always necessarily deal directly with the API. A lot of times there's libraries that will really help you out. So, like I said, I'm at Portland Community College, and it's been kind of a struggle there. I'm actually one of the newer members. I've only been there about 5 years, and it's been kind of a struggle to get people to embrace using outside web services. To me, really, it's all about getting more done while doing less. And that's really important when you look at the numbers. So Portland Community College is a pretty big place. We have three main campuses scattered throughout the city and throughout the local area. These are full-size campuses with lots of students, tracks, bookstores, all that good stuff. We also have 7 centers, which are not quite campuses. They're probably missing a bookstore or a track. But they're still large places where students go. 2 of those were built in the past year, so we're expanding rapidly. There are over 100 locations in the community where people take community ed classes, and those are constantly changing every term. We have about 3,000 employees, and by the end of this year, we'll be serving 100,000 students a year. So it's a really large school. We're actually bigger than all of the universities in the state combined when it comes to students. We have to compare those numbers, though, those very big numbers, to this number. This is the web team. We're responsible for all web services at the college. And actually, for this talk today, this number is actually quite a bit lower because one of these people is my manager. One of them takes care of the portal 24 hours a day and does nothing else. And one of them takes care of the servers and the backend databases. So really, it's me and Karen, my web developer, who take care of all of the public sites, the intranet, and everything else. So this doing less and getting more done mantra has been really important to us to be able to offer services at the college to our users. But there are considerations. When I first got there about 5 years ago, there were in-house homegrown apps for a variety of things, for photo galleries, video, news aggregation. And in many ways, there still are homegrown apps there that we're maintaining on a daily basis. When we started looking at moving away from building new homegrown apps and working with web services provided by other large companies, there were a lot of things to consider. When you have a homegrown app, you really have to start from scratch. That means setting up the database, putting in the initial content, setting up the CRUD operations, create, retrieve, update, delete. And once you have all that, then you can look at the user interface. With an API, the database is handled by the web service. The API is your CRUD operation. It's the way that you interact with the data. So when you use an API, you can usually just jump right in and start worrying about the user interface, how people are going to see this data, what they're going to be able to do with this data, rather than worrying about the storage and transmission of data. Talking about data, homegrown apps, usually the data does a single task. So if we've got a video that's hosted just on our site, people are only going to see it when they come to our site. If that said video's on YouTube, sure, they'll see it on our site, but they'll also see it when they're going around YouTube and hopefully direct some more traffic back to our site. Same thing with a variety of media. You could also consider the bandwidth. We actually have great bandwidth at the college, but it's never going to compare to Yahoo's bandwidth. So when we're serving up images, if we're serving them directly from Yahoo via Flickr, the end user is going to get the fastest possible results, which is great for everybody. On the flip side, though, you may get Yahoo's bandwidth, but you also get Twitter's uptime. This means that you don't only have to consider about your service going down, but you have to consider about this web service going down. And Twitter's a notorious case where it tends to go down at the worst possible times. Now, there are easy ways to mitigate this. One thing that we often do is that we actually cache a copy of the data on our servers. And so the next time we hit the service like Twitter, if it's not available, we can just serve up the cached copy. It's not that difficult to do, but it's just an extra layer that you have to think about when you're using an outside set of services. And finally, the big one for a lot of people at my institution, control. When you do a homegrown app in-house, you control the database, you control the content, you control the coding, you control the access, but you're also completely responsible for all the bug fixes, you're completely responsible for all the new requests and features that are added to it. So it's a trade-off. And for us, I really kind of had to dive in and start using some, start putting up some maps, working with YouTube video a little bit more to show the advantages versus a lot of the concerns that were out there. So with that, I think we're going to jump right in and talk about maps. It's a really good place to start. I'm not sure if I was going to do this, but how many people have a Google map on their site right now? Okay, good. That's a good number of you. It's a great one to start with because maps is not something that you would want to do in-house. Wait, I should ask, is anybody doing maps in-house? Okay. It's a huge issue to create maps. I mean, acquiring the satellite imagery, let alone driving around the entire world trying to figure out the best directions, it's not something that you really want to do in-house. And Google offers this, and Yahoo and other services too. I'm just going to use Google as an example because it's what we use. they offer this free, and they offer you a lot of cool support for it. So for those of you who haven't put a map in, and again, this code right here, you probably can't read. It's all on the website. Don't sweat it. It's just to have me be able to follow along and show you with the example. So here's a simple map for one of our galleries. It's in line in a web page. You're not seeing the rest of the web page. And this is using Google Maps version 3. It's their third version of the JavaScript API. And it's got a lot of cool advantages if you're using any of the other versions. One of the advantages is that it doesn't require a key. Previous versions, you had to go register with them and set up a key, which wasn't hard, and it was free. But this, you could just take this snippet from my site, put it on your site, and it'll work right away. Here you can see that it's using JavaScript. It includes a JavaScript library directly from Google. And then we simply set up the map. This is using jQuery, but it's not necessary. The stuff inside will look exactly the same. We set a latitude and longitude. We set some options, the zoom level, the map type, and there's a couple different map types that you can do. And then we create a map and drop it into an element on the page. So in this case, we're dropping it into a divide called map canvas, and we're even setting a marker. And this little snippet of code is great. It's very simple, and suddenly they've got a real map. They can drag and drop things around. They can click on the marker if they want. They could go to Google Maps and get directions for it. One thing that I will note here is we often, when we do this for real, we'll take an image and put it inside of the divide that we're replacing. Because if somebody's JavaScript turned off, of course, they can't use Google Maps, but they'll still be able to see the static image of the map. Just another step we do to try to make things as accessible as possible. So here's a more interesting example. This is a map from 50th.pcc.edu. A couple months ago, marketing came to me and said, our 50th anniversary is coming up next year, and we need a site. We want to, in preparation, start collecting stories from staff, students, anybody who's ever been touched by Portland Community College. And I went, okay, it's really cool. We could set up a form and do that. Or we could set up an interactive map where people could actually put their markers directly on the map. So if you go to 50th.pcc.edu, and you can do that whenever you want, you click on Add a Mark to the Map, you go in there, and how it works is the JavaScript is exactly the same way for displaying the map, but all the data is pulled dynamically from WordPress. This is just a WordPress installation where I put a custom post type called map, and when someone enters their story, it records the story and records the metadata for the latitude and longitude. And this little snippet right here is just the query posts from WordPress, which you should be familiar with if you've ever used WordPress. And it's taking the latitude and longitude metadata, and it's creating an array that's fed right into the JavaScript, and boom, we have an interactive map. This was incredibly fast for me to set up. This map took me, 10 minutes to set up. The WordPress installation with everything else probably took an hour. So we were rapidly prototyping this and getting feedback on it as it was being developed.
Good problem?
Yeah. My teeth?
Maybe.
Or at least I'm hearing music. I got somebody else to corroborate it.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. I was too. I was like, I'm going nuts.
Can we hear this? Is that on? Is that loud enough?
I still hear it. We still got the music, but can we hear Gabriel?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, cool. Well, we'll have music. Is it good music? I can't. Okay.
Don't mind me. I'm going to see what I can do with that. Please continue.
I'm going to keep going. So the other interesting thing about this map is that the map itself isn't the only thing that uses the API on the page. Right? We're asking people, and this is the little form that you see when you click it, ask them to put in their address. And when they put in their address, it actually uses the JavaScript data API from Google, which is also freely available, and it creates a geocoder to actually take that text and convert it into a latitude longitude. And we actually do something, it's as simple as this, geocoder, new geocoder, and then address, and we do the function, and we get the results for the geometry location. So it's this little snippet of code, takes my home address, and converts it into this latitude longitude over here. And what's really cool is that we actually wanted to give some feedback to let the person know that they're in the right city. Because if I type in my address, 6330 Northeast Emerson, it's actually the first hit is in Texas. Yeah, I know. I don't know why they don't like me, but the first hit is in Texas. So what we do is we reverse geocode the latitude, longitude, and then in this green right here, we spit back out, once they've done typing, the city, the state, and the country. So we're able to give them immediately via JavaScript feedback to say, oh yeah, you're in the right city, we got your address, we know where you are. And the full code for this is a lot of if, else statements, depending on, you know, what things happen. But the heart of it, it really is just these five lines of code right here. And that's it. And it's a really cool thing. We've had 50 or 60, we just launched a site a couple weeks ago, we've had 50 or 60 people put in their information, put their mark on the map, and there's been no trouble with this piece. There's been no learning curve. You know, it's just a regular Google map, they hit it, they type in their address, and it's up and going. Another thing we do with maps that's quite interesting is for maintenance, right? So we've got, these are our parking locations. So this is everywhere on PCC that they parole for parking, to make sure people aren't parking in the neighborhoods and, you know, ticking locals off. And we used to maintain these via separate Google Maps, because we've got 10 locations that we do these for. Now what we do is we take a single KML, which is a Google Maps document, and we actually let parking go ahead and edit that, because it's a pretty easy thing to do in Google Earth. Sorry if I said Google Maps. In Google Earth, they go ahead and they draw the shape, and we take that, and it's simply, we create a KML layer, and it pulls that one file and displays the locations on all 10 of those maps. So it's a really nice way to maintain data, not just display it. And it's been a great thing for us. Okay, photos. We use Flickr pretty exclusively for photos now because there's a great API that's out there. If you go to their documentation, there's a whole app garden that you can explore and look through, which is kind of cool. The two important things I'd like to note about Flickr is, one, you do require a key, so you have to register with them and get a key. And that lets them make sure that the requests are coming from your site and that you're not doing a billion function calls a day to their service. If you are doing a billion function calls, you probably have to have some type of agreement with them. The other thing to note is that they do use RESTful XML. So the way it works is you hit a URL with your query, and it displays the XML and pulls it back. And sometimes it can be kind of ugly and daunting to someone who doesn't work in that way. But that's all right. There's these extra libraries that are written on top of that that make things really, really simple. So why would you want to use Flickr versus there are tons of in-house apps that you can host for doing photo galleries. Well, Flickr is great at organizing photos, at organizing groups, which means, you know, people who don't even have the same accounts, at managing and maintaining photos. And because of this, I found that a lot of my users were already using Flickr. They were already there. This was what they did. If I had to transition them to an in-house app, there would be a learning curve. And there was no reason to do this because I can take their photos directly out of their sets, display them on the website, and the end user's happy, they're happy, and it really simplifies things. Here's a gallery that we did for this public event we call Artbeat. And the cool thing about this is not a set from one user. This is actually a group. People from the public are able to submit photos to this. And the way that Flickr works is that we have one of the members of the committee for Artbeat moderating these. So we make sure that we don't get anything that, you know, we don't want to see up there. As soon as they moderate something, it appears on Flickr so people can find it there, and it appears in this gallery. We actually say, this is from an Artbeat group pool on Flickr. But if we didn't put that, users would never know where these photos came from. When you click on one of these, it actually opens up in a nice lightbox effect. It doesn't even take them to Flickr. It's up to you how much you want to tell your users what you're doing on the back end, because most of the times they don't care. They're just seeing a cool gallery. This uses a jQuery library called, I think, jQuery Flickr, which makes the whole thing really easy. You put in your API key. You put in the group ID. You can also set a callback. So, excuse me. In this case, it's a lightbox callback, which gives that cool effect that we're using. And it's completely hands-off as soon as I set this up. The committee takes care of the photos in Flickr. gets displayed here, and I don't have to worry about maintaining any software. This is a little bit more of a complicated example. It's actually not an educational example, so I hope you'll excuse me for a second. This is a site I built for some friends of mine who make these custom cargo bikes. In this case, it's a beer bike, which hauls two full kegs around Portland. They had an awful website that was all done in Flash, but worse than that, in my mind, is that they were using Flickr really heavily. But when they wanted photo on their Flash site, they had to upload it to Flickr, and then they had to go and upload it to their Flash site. So they just weren't. There were no photos on their Flash site. So what we did is I set them up with a WordPress installation, and I created this widget in the admin console where they can simply type in the set ID. They go into Flickr, they create a set, they type in the set ID, and when the page is rendered, a PHP function goes through and creates this dynamic interactive gallery. And it's as simple as that from their perspective. That's all they have to do. If they go and they change one of the photos on Flickr, it automatically changes on this side. So again, it makes maintenance of these kind of web pages incredibly simple. All right, we're rushing ahead. We're going to talk about video, which is one of my favorite things to talk about because we've done a lot with video. I actually gave a presentation 2 years ago here about accessible video. Since then, we've actually moved to YouTube. We have an educational partnership with YouTube, which if you don't have one, definitely I'd look into it. No advertising, no time limit, as long as you have educational material up there. The one problem that I see with it, well, I guess I'm skipping ahead a little bit. I should say there are two different, YouTube offers two different APIs. One for the player, it's controlling the player, and one for managing the content, so uploading, editing, that kind of stuff. And I wanted to show you first the player API really quickly. This is a little site that I put together last year called YouTube CC. Surprisingly, YouTube hasn't bothered me about the name yet. Probably because it does a good thing. It's for captioning video. This took me about a night to write. It's all in JavaScript using the JavaScript player API. It allows you to put in the address of any YouTube video that's out there, and it brings it up in this nice little setup here where you can play, pause the video, and add captions. If you click on one of the captions you've already done, the video goes back to that section and lets you recaption it. So this whole thing is an application where people can caption videos from any YouTube video, then download them and do whatever they want with them. And again, it took me just about a night to do, which was good because we don't use this thing anymore. YouTube actually has this cool auto timing feature inside of it, which I recommend you look into, which kind of made this whole thing a moot point. But it didn't matter to me. I didn't take a week or a month to build this. I prototyped it up in an afternoon, built it that night, pushed it out, we used it for a couple months, and then when something better came along, we went with that. It is still up for archiving. It still gets, surprisingly, about a dozen or so videos captioned in a day, so I'm not planning to take it down. But it is a bit buggy. I haven't really been maintaining it, so if you find any errors in it, let me know. The other API is a data API, and this is the cool one. We've got an educational partnership. Good advantage to that. A lot of cool things you can do. The problem in my mind is that they only give you one login and one password, right? And I don't want to share that with every single faculty at my institution. I'm not even comfortable sharing it with all the instructional support people because if one of them went rogue, not that they would, but if they did, they could change the password and lock everybody out. So we turned to the API to take care of this, to the upload version of the API. And what we decided to do was we have our own credential system on our servers. We've got this where they can access different services, and we put an upload form behind that. And it's a little bit complicated, so I'm just going to show you. This is a graph directly from YouTube's API, and I'm going to show you how this actually works when a user does it. So the user's browser comes to our application, and we send them a form. This form asks for a title, a description, some of the textual stuff that YouTube requires. That's sent back to us. We then, on our side, take it and send that off to YouTube and request a unique URL and a key, one-time key, to upload a video. Because they don't want people, you know, they want to be very strict with security when it comes to uploading videos. They don't want a lot of spam videos just automatically being uploaded. They send us back that URL and key, and we can then create a second form which the user can browse, select a video, and hit upload. When they do that, and this is the important thing, the video goes straight to YouTube. It doesn't go to our servers at all. It doesn't take any of our bandwidth. It doesn't take any of our memory. It goes straight to YouTube. Then YouTube redirects them to our application, and we can do whatever we want. We give them a confirmation. So from the end user, here's what it looks like. They start out by logging in with their credentials, their MyPCC credentials, which is something that we use for our portal and places all over the website. They then get a list of the things they have access to. This is my list, so it's a little bit longer. A lot of them will only see video upload. That's the important one for this purpose. When they click on it, they get this form here, which is that first set, which lets them enter data. Now, this is a good place to reinforce what can and cannot be uploaded to an educational site. I highly stress doing that. Even if you do this, even if they have to look at this every single time, they'll still find a way to upload stuff that they shouldn't. 2 weeks ago, they were uploading Star Wars clips. I'm not kidding. And I didn't understand the educational purpose, but you know, if anybody's going to come after us, George Lucas would be it. So the good thing, though, is that we actually warn them in here that what we do to take care of that is we tag every video in the normal YouTube tags with part of their username. So if something gets uploaded that's questionable, we can figure out who it is. And it still happens. It's pretty amazing. So they fill out this form, and then all this magic happens in the background, and they're immediately taken to the upload form. They don't see any of that junk in the background. That's all handled between my server and the API. They can then select a video. 2 gigabytes was the old. I think it's now 20 gigabytes that they can upload. And since it's not hitting our servers, it's going straight to YouTube, we don't care what the size is. The bigger, the better. We have full HD videos that are being put up there. We had one, an HD video that was an hour long. I did not want that hitting our servers. Go straight there. It takes a few minutes, depending on the size of the video, and then this is what they get. They get a confirmation on our site saying, here you go, here's your video. This is great. I mean, it completely bypasses all of the concerns that we have about video on our servers, but still gives us the control to let certain people in and keep other people out. It's a great balance for what we do. This is what the video looks like when it's on YouTube. And you can see this, along with their normal tags, this J Johnstow, that's part of a username that we put in there. So if we need to, we can go back and look. It's a simple way. There's other ways to do it, but it's a simple way that we're able to keep track of who's uploading the Star Wars clips. And it wasn't Jim, so he said I could use his name. All right, so my final set of examples, which is good, because I think we're pretty much right on time. We've got about 15 minutes, and I'm hoping there are some questions, is analytics. And analytics is kind of cool because it's not used as much as these other three. I think the other three are used a lot, but analytics is often ignored. If you've got the Google tracking code on your site and you're using Google Analytics anyway, you're already accumulating all of this data, so you might as well do something cool with it. Of course, you can display it. This is actually not something I wrote. This is a WordPress plugin. Really simple, uses the API, grabs your newest stats, displays it in a really simple way right on your WordPress admin site or on the external site if you want to show it to visitors. Simple. A little more complicated. Well, I shouldn't even say complicated because it's really not, but you can grab individual queries and do things with them. So in this case, on our news site, we wanted to show the most viewed articles, but we didn't want to keep track of that. There's no reason to keep track of that in WordPress or on our server since we're already keeping track of it in analytics. So here, this is in PHP. I'm requiring the GAPI PHP class, which I downloaded directly from Google. They host this. Well, we host it, but they're the ones who gave it to us, I should say. We set up a GAPI using our credentials, normal credentials that we would log into analytics with. And then we simply do a report data request. And in this case, we want to get the page titles of the top X amount of pages. And then we can just sort those into a list and spit them out. And this is a good place where we do caching on our side, just in case a request fails. Those top 10 probably don't change on every time somebody hits the site. So we cache it, and then if we can't reach the service, we use the cache copy of it. But we've never even noticed it being a problem. Here's my favorite example. This is our search. It's a little bit heavy on the search on this side. But the cool thing in this example that I want to show is on the right-hand side, we show the top 25 searches in a little cloud. And we used to do this by hand. We used to get the Google Analytics and take the top 25 and write it out and put them over there. And that was fine. People found it really useful. We did this every month. Now that we have the API, it's automagic. Right? We just go in and every time somebody hits this page, it reaches in and it grabs the top 25 searches and it puts it on the page. The interesting part of this for us, and this is why I love APIs, is now that it's being done automatically, I can really think about what's going on, what to display. So when you're doing top 25 searches, should I display the top 25 today, this week? That might not reflect what people are looking for because the searches are constantly changing depending on what part of the term you're in. Do I do all-time searches? Well, I mean, there could be things in there that they cared about 5 years ago that they don't care about today. It's very likely. So what we decided on after doing some testing and going around and doing some user testing on different people, which was great because this thing we just prototyped really quick, had it out there running, and we had a couple different versions, was we decided to take the results, the top 25 results, from a year ago plus or minus a week. So that gives us a range at this point in the term, at this term in the year. So on the first day of classes, they're likely to get search results in the cloud that are related to the first day of classes, and so on and so forth. And again, I set it up, I forget it, I haven't had to touch it in a year and a half. It's been great. All right, so looking forward, and I actually have to find my set of notes because I want to read something off to you. I just want to talk about a couple points about what I feel the future of APIs are. First of all, I think there is going to be more of them. It's something that the big companies are releasing that are very handy, that people are doing some really cool things with, mashing up cool applications, doing stuff with their cool data. And so I showed you just a couple of them. Included with these, I have personally used Amazon, Basecamp, BizRate, Delicious, Doppler, Etsy, Facebook, Foursquare, FriendFeed, GitHub, .gov, IMDb, LastFM, LinkedIn, MediaWiki, Microsoft Netflix, Newegg, NPR, which is kind of a cool one, New York Times, OpenID, Tumblr, Twitter, which I do have examples of that on my site, Vimeo, Weather, White Pages, and Zillow's. Those are all available right now to get a lot or at least some of the functionality out of those sites and really make your life a lot easier. Also, I see these things getting safer for the end user. This is OAuth. This is something that Twitter went to very recently that actually made working with the API a little bit harder, but it made it much safer for the end user. It used to be that when you had a Twitter app, you had to ask the user for their username and password, and you would be the one storing that. Which, you know, you can trust me, sure, but I don't know about all those people who are asking for my username and password. With OAuth, and I'm not going to go through the exact way that you do it, they get passed to Twitter and authorized there, and your application is then authorized to do things with their account. It's a lot safer for the end user, a little more complicated on the API side, but really it makes people trust these kind of outside API-based applications a lot more. Makes it a lot safer. The other thing that I look forward to, and I recommend that you go and play with, is these one-stop shops for API. So I was introduced just a couple months ago, it's been out there for a while, YQL. YQL is Yahoo's API thing that they've been doing. It basically takes all the different APIs, most of the ones I just named off that I've played around with, puts them into one spot where not only do you have access to all these different APIs in one spot, but you can actually use them via SQL-like queries. So here, select all from maps.map where zip equals this, and it'll return. And there's your actual formatted view, and it gives you the REST query and all this stuff. And you can mix and match these together and do really cool things. Give me the weather at this location and driving directions. Give me, you know, depends what you're looking for. You can just mash them together really quick and make these really nice queries. And the end result, you're using the Yahoo API to reach out and hit Google or IMDb or FriendFeed or New York Times, whatever you want. And so it's really one-stop shopping for APIs. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. I haven't used it extensively, but I hope that you'll go to developer.yahoo, play around with this thing. This console's online, so you can do live stuff. All right, so I'd like to take a couple minutes for questions, see what people have to say. Again, all my source files and code are on gabriel.nagme.com. If you have any questions, because they're not all complete, I put up useful snippets. I hope they're useful. But if you have any questions at all, you can contact me. I'm always on Twitter. And I'm happy to share anything that we've done, except for my username and password. Any of the code that we've done, I'm very happy to share. Questions? Would you like to come up and use the mic? Come on down.
With Flickr, can you talk a little bit about how you've got it set up on your campus with regard to departments or what kind of separate accounts, or are they using the free account and having a limit of 200 photos and that kind of thing? That's an independent issue on our campus.
Okay. Thank you. You're coming all the way down. We started out small with it. We had an original paid account, so it was unlimited for the web team that we were using, and we started there, and we started managing photos. Now that we're using the API, we're letting people set up their own accounts, and in a lot of cases, they're setting up groups, so it's not just their uploads, but it's other people's uploads. We do put, because we're the ones to build the web pages, we know where it's pointing to. They can't just point it to a new gallery or a new post or a new set, so we look at that when we set it up. But the onus is really on them for what photos are in there and if they want to pay for the Flickr account or not. And it really hasn't been much of an issue. Our foundation, I think, has paid for one because they use it extensively. Like every event, they take pictures themselves and they put up a lot of photos. Everybody else has been using free accounts. It's been working out pretty good. Other questions? Really? Oh, good. Come on down.
For your Google Maps example, what type of moderation do you guys use for the people that are contributing to that map?
Awesome. Thank you. That's a really good question, Matt. We just set this up. This is one of our first experiments with moderation of this type, really. And when we originally set it up, people were like, okay, everything needs to be moderated. I actually have a little bit of code that says, you know, we look at every post and spam or gibberish or hate mail will be removed. We have the right to remove anything. Just a little bit, you know, of code that says, you're cool, so you probably won't do this, but if you do, we're going to not post your thing. The problem was is that they couldn't immediately see what they posted. So they put a story in there, and it just brought them to a blank kind of page that said thanks. And people weren't sharing these online in any of the social networks. And we got these great little share buttons. We want them to share it so more people know. So I convinced my team and marketing, we talked to them a little bit because they had a big deal in this, to open it up. And it's completely open. As soon as somebody posts something, it immediately appears on the map. Now, I get a notification of that. So just like YouTube, where I'm following along, doing some after-the-fact moderation, we're doing the same kind of thing there. And it works really well. We actually haven't had any problems yet with it. Nobody's put in bogus stories. But even if they did, it would be an hour or possibly the next day, and we would take it down. So I really like the post first, moderate later kind of policy for these things. It makes the web more live in this kind of case. Is there another one back there? All the way in the back. See, if you sit in the back, you got to come all the way down.
Have you run into a situation where an API has changed or the result set given back to you from the API has broken some of the code that you've previously written?
Yes, and that is a really good question because it's happened to us twice with two different APIs, and this is one of the things you do have to watch out for. This is where you lose control a little bit, and you do have to do some maintenance. The first one was with YouTube's. They changed theirs ever so slightly. We jumped on YouTube's that API when it first came out. And so it was, they didn't label it beta, but it was very much beta. And they changed it, and we had to react. But luckily, since we were doing it through our servers, we were doing some checks and balances so that when it broke, it said, unable to do this request, please contact your administrator, and it gave him my name. So we found out about that really quick. It was a simple change. The other one was a little bit harder, which I didn't talk about Twitter, But when they went to OAuth, I had written all these plugins for WordPress. I had done all this cool stuff with it, and it all broke. And it was not a simple matter to go in and update it. I've updated some of them, but not all of them, just because I have to go and touch them all. But in that case, Twitter did the right thing. They gave people months ahead notice. They let you know that this was going to happen. And if I had been diligent about it, if I had really cared about those and they were being used heavily, I would have gone in and updated them beforehand. So it is something you have to watch out for. Definitely putting those checks and balances when you're doing it on your server so you know when something goes down. But in all the APIs we've been using, it's happened twice. And in both cases, we found out about it almost immediately. Any others? Hey.
I don't know about anyone else in the room. I'm more of a designer than a programmer. How well are these APIs documented and how to use them?
It depends on the API. I've got 1 minute left to get this really quick. My title is also designer, by the way, and I just want to let people know. That's why I said this is semi-technical, because I'm of the feeling if you see something cool that you want to do, you'll figure out how to do it, or you'll get the people around you to help you out to figure out how to do it. Google's APIs, they've got an entire forums in the Google code base that just really make it accessible. Flickr's not so much, but there are some base examples that are out there. If you've got a grasp of JavaScript, even a basic one, you should be able to dive in and do some of these really cool things. I think that's about it. All right. Thank you.